This Brains R Us, the science of educating, is extremely topical at the moment. You probably, some of you will have seen this. You may wonder why this child is being attacked by clocks. But as if you read the thing, we make this the sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek claim that timing is everything. That's why we have a Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center. And that was from journal JCOG Neuroscience, by the way, in February. You can't get away from it, really, can you? In the last 2 weeks, the New York Times has had a story on play, which is part of our subject, the How to Make Better Teachers on Time magazine only last week. This one, Should Boys and Girls Be Taught Separately? There's so much issues about education at the moment that I think this is an enormously timely conference. I just did want to mention one thing, which is that we are so glad that this is being hosted at the Salk Institute. One of the people who was a founding fellow in the middle there of the Salk Institute and its deputy director was Jacob Bronowski, who did a television series that you may remember called The Ascent of Man, apart from some other wonderful books on science and human values and so on. And I think that this whole notion of outreach, communication with society is something that Bruno would have been very pleased about. And it's fitting that this is, in fact, his centennial year. Officially, his birthday was January the 18th, 1908. I actually think that somewhere in the records it was somewhere last November in Poland, but we're celebrating it here. It seems an appropriate time to do that. Gary Cottrell has now got a badge on and is ready to come up. He's the Temple. He's the our fearless leader at the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, and he's about to speak to you.
So, as the director of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, I want to welcome you all to our first town hall meeting, and I apologize for being late. You know how Route 5 is in the morning. So the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center is a collection of about 40 or 50 researchers spread all over this country, Canada, and Australia. And we're working on the problem of understanding how time and timing affects learning. So every day we send our kids to school and they come home with a changed brain. This is a synapse growing, which you'll probably see again in Rusty's talk. And this is Andrea Chiva's daughter. So the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center is, again, dedicated to understanding the role of time and timing in learning. And we're doing this through a cooperative research structure, which we think is pretty innovative compared to the standard competitive research structure that we think leads to literature that is like a bunch of blind men looking at an elephant. Instead, we hope through the cooperative research structure to see the whole elephant. And so we have networks of interdisciplinary scientists approaching this issue from multiple perspectives. So through this work, we hope to develop new transform education in the United States by, we are inspired by the work of Paula Talal and Mike Mersnick of UCSF, who first realized the role of time and timing in the problem of poor readers. So they applied Mike's discovery of neural plasticity, that is, you'll probably hear that word a lot today, or that phrase, and what it means is it's the ability of the brain to rewire itself in response to repeated structured stimulation. And they used this idea to develop a video game called Fast for Word that helps remedy the timing problem that they saw in poor readers. And this is a thing we hope to replicate many times in our center. So here's an example that I like to show. I hope Paula is probably going to show it again in her talk. So this baby is learning, so these two tones, the boo-boo, boo-boo, the gap between those is 70 milliseconds. And when it's different, the baby has learned, when it goes beep, the baby has learned that there are very interesting things going on to its left. Okay. Now, some babies can't do this. at 70 milliseconds gap. They need boop, beep. And what Paula discovered was that babies with that problem that have a slow shutter speed, essentially, can't learn language as well as babies that can do that. And the reason is that if you can't detect boop-beep, you can't understand speech very well. Okay, so speech is a lot of rapid auditory transitions, and kids that, babies that can't do that, you can predict that they can't, they'll have poor reading skills and poor language skills at 3 years of age when you test them at 6 months of age. And so what they found was that training children, when Paula saw what Mike Merznick had done and his work in neuroplasticity, what they showed is that training children on this boop-beep task, actually, in a video game, improved their language skills and then improved their reading skills. And so they developed the Fast for Word program that many of you educators are familiar with. And this is an experience that we hope to repeat many times in our center. And we're doing that. So we're developing Ruby, a social robot that teaches preschoolers their colors and shapes according to California standards. She's a kind of big Teletubby. This is a project of Javier Mavellan's lab at the Institute for Neural Computation at UCSD. We're finding that the optimal times to present material again for maximum retention in real educational settings. This is an experiment being carried out by Hal Pashler of UCSD's psychology department at UCSD's award-winning Proy School on our campus. We're developing an interactive video game inspired by the Fast for Word program that trains children with autism who have social deficits how to recognize faces and facial expressions. And Javier's work on facial expression recognition is being used in this system to augment it so that it can give real-time feedback to the kids as they're making facial expressions. So it'll be able to read their facial expressions and see how well they're making them. So we can't do all this, though, by sitting in the proverbial ivory tower. So today's meeting is an example of our practice of outreach and inreach. Inreach being hearing from you, the educators and the parents, about what your problems are in education so that we can direct our science towards more educationally relevant goals. And this is my thought bomb. It's a line from our original proposal for the Center for the Temporal Dynamics of Learning. Thank you.
So next is Rusty Gage, who's Adler Professor of Genetics here at the Salk Institute. I think he's going to talk about newborn neuron.
So I'm from the Salk Institute. My name's Rusty Gage, and I work on the development of new brain cells in the adult nervous system. And about 10 years ago, we found that humans, as well as all other mammalian species, have what are called stem cells in their brain, and that these brain cells can divide and give rise to new neurons throughout life. And just as an example, this is a mammalian brain, and this structure here is called the dentate gyrus, and each of these green cells are newly born cells that have emerged into the circuitry at midlife. And this all occurred within about, these cells were all born within about an hour and a half, and it takes about a month for them to extend what these branches are called, their dendrites out here, and their axons, which is what they make connections with, out here. So all mammals have new cells growing in their brain all the time. Now, it's not a fixed effect. In other words, it's not pre-programmed to occur at a certain rate. In fact, experience has a great thing to do with whether or not these cells are born and to the extent that they're born and whether or not they survive. So acute stress can block the proliferation of these cells for transient periods of time. Chronic stress will block this new birth entirely for long periods, even after the stress has been removed. On the good side, physical exercise, movement in your environment, just walking around and maybe a little faster clip, will increase the rate at which these cells divide. So if they've slowed down for whatever reason, physical movement in the environment will increase the rate at which the cells are being brought into the circuitry. Environmental enrichment, or complexity of the environment, changing complexity in the environment, has a direct relationship to whether or not the cells that are born survive and integrate into the circuitry. And they can affect, in fact, the rate at which the cells make connections. So there are thousands of connections coming in from the cortex on the surface of all of these cells. And there are thousands of connections coming out from these cells, making contact here and out here. So part of what we do is try to figure out how this happens at a molecular and cellular level. What are the genes and proteins that control this? But the other side of it is, what is it? Why is this happening? Why is it that the adult nervous system in this one structure would retain the capacity for generating new neurons? Because as it turns out, this is one of the only two areas of the brain where neurogenesis occurs. Certainly synaptic plasticity and formation of new connections are being made in other parts of the brain, but new neurons being integrated into the circuitry is only occurring in these two structures. So the dentate is part of a structure called the hippocampus, and the hippocampus is involved in the acquisition of new memories. And current thinking is that the dentate, which is the first relay station of information coming in from the cortex, has a principal role in what's called pattern separation. The dentate's role in life is to distinguish between two closely related events that occur in time. Make sure you can separate them out and distinguish between the two of them. After a lot of modeling and experiments, our current view of the role that the new neurons play in this structure is not to enhance the distinction between these two events, but rather to generalize between these two events. So the new neurons pass through a period of time after their birth where they're hyperexcitable. And what they do is they generalize about the experience perceived in two different instances. And they carry that generalization forward. One can test this subsequently by either removing the new neurogenesis, blocking the birth of the new cells, and asking what sort of detriments are involved. And principally, what's involved is an inability to generalize between two closely related events, but rather it optimizes. And this is on a temporal basis, and we call this temporal coding. But the take-home message I'd like to leave you with is that you all, we all, and our kids have new cells being born in their brains, and the extent to which those newborn cells are integrating into the circuitry is dependent upon their physical and mental interaction with their environment. So as a neurobiologist, I believe that the brain is the organ that controls our behavior. And the surprising do loop is that that's true. On the other hand, what we do, the behaviors we emit, can feed back and change the structure of our brain. Thank you.
Thank you, Raspi. Terry is next up. Terry Sanofsky is the director of the Crick Jacobs Center here and also of the Institute for Neural Computation at UCSD and the co-director of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center and a few other things. Terry.
Okay, well, to welcome everybody here and looking forward to all of the discussions we're going to have today. And we were asked to give a small little thought bomb in Roger's terminology, just to give you a flavor of some of the discoveries, the really exciting things that are happening in neuroscience that really are directly relevant And Rusty didn't mention it, but the proliferation and the survival of the neurons also depends on exercise. It's not just a new experience, but in mice at least, having an exercise wheel could significantly change the number of neurons that are integrated into this very important structure. Now, the connections between neurons are at locations called synapses, and we believe, on the basis of a lot of experimental evidence, that changes in the strengths of the synapses may be important for learning. And I just want to give you an idea, first of all, historically, how we came to this idea, and secondly, how our ideas have changed very recently within the last decade about how that happens. So I'd like to introduce you to Donald Hebb, who's here on the left. Donald Hebb was a psychologist, a Canadian psychologist, who was interested in how brains develop, and in particular, how cognitive abilities develop. He published a book in 1949 that was very influential called The Organization of Behavior. And in this book, he speculated about how the strengths of synapses might be changed in order to create a new memory. And this type of synapse that I'm going to describe in a second is now called a Hebb synapse, after him. And in some ways, the Hebb synapse is more famous than Donald Hebb himself. So here's a picture of artist's rendition of what a neuron at a synaptic junction between two neurons looks like. This is an axon coming down, and this is a little bulb here called a presynaptic terminal. And in it, there's little transmitter molecules that upon stimulation of the nerve, release the transmitter. It diffuses across to the postsynaptic terminal, and this is a little spine-like excrescence coming off the dendritic spine of neuron of the second neuron. So that's the postsynaptic side. So that's the business end of how neurons communicate. Now, here's what Donald Hebb. By the way, there are no equations in the book. In 1949, very little was known about synapses. It really was on the horizon for studying these mechanisms, which subsequently now we know quite a bit about. But here's what he speculated. He said that the strength of the synapse should change when an axon of cell A, that's this one, is near enough to excite cell B, that's this one here, or repeatedly or persistently takes part in firing it. Some growth process or metabolic change takes place in one or both cells such that A's efficiency as one of the cells firing B is increased. And this was the basis of the idea that if you want to change the strength of the synapse, you needed to have coinciding activity, simultaneous activity on both the presynaptic side and the postsynaptic side. It's a two-way street. You need to have both occurring at the same time. And that's what has become to be called the Hebb synapse. Now, it was pure speculation until 1975 when physiologists discovered in the hippocampus that the change in synaptic strengths in the dentate gyrus, exactly the place that Rusty was telling you about in the last lecture, that if you stimulate that synapse at a high rate, 100 hertz, you can increase the strength of the synapse. And it was subsequently shown that you have to have both presynaptic release of the transmitter and a strongly depolarized postsynaptic cell to create the strength increase. And that really was a confirmation that Hebb was right. He was on the right track. However, and now this is the exciting thing, about 10 years ago, physiologists discovered a new form of strengthening called spike-dependent potentiation, STDP. And what they discovered was that what's important is not just that you have simultaneous activity, but you have the cell A has to fire before cell B. If A comes before B, and if you repeat that, you strengthen the synapse. But if you do it in the opposite order, if B comes before A, it actually decreases the strength of the synapse. Now, that may sound like a very small change, but it has enormous implications because in the first case, theorists have shown that that's a very good simultaneity, is a very good way of creating associations. But with this sequence order being important, it allows the synapse and the neurons to memorize sequences of stimuli. And in fact, it's the difference between associating, for example, two words versus being able to memorize a whole sentence. It has enormous implications. And the key idea is that the second form of the synapse is a form of prediction. And in fact, if you go back and read what Hebb actually said, he didn't say that when they're firing together. He said when A participates in firing B. In fact, implicit in what he thought was already the idea that the second form of plasticity should really be the one that's important. Now, everything I've told you so far is discoveries made here down at the level of synapses, but this level of synapses here on the scale from molecules up to the central nervous system is just the first step, because these changes at synapses have influences on how neurons fire, which in turn affect how networks respond to complex sensory stimuli, and that in turn affects behavior. And you'll be hearing in Andrea Chiba's lecture next how this idea of prediction is a very powerful one that helps us to organize how the brains respond to the world. Thank you.
So next up is Andrea Chiba, who's another co-director of the TDLC, Associate Professor of Cognitive Science at UCSD, and the mother of one of the children in Gary's talk, the child in Gary's talk.
So often in cognitive neuroscience, we take this sort of textbook view of brain function. We often attribute particular functions to particular regions of the brain. For example, maybe judgment, foresight to the frontal lobe, perhaps emotional functions to aspects of the temporal lobe. And whereas this is quite reasonable in many respects, we also have to bear in mind that the brain is under absolutely no obligation whatsoever to operate according to these psychological principles that we impose on it. And so what we need to understand is how the brain learns. At the most basic level, which Terry was just speaking of, how is it that the brain learns? And we also need to remember that there are very many basic units of the brain, and that time is an organizing principle of the brain, such that on multiple levels of analysis, from the synapse and spike time-dependent plasticity, which you just heard about, to spikes or action potentials coming from a neuron, to many neurons screaming in a local field potential, to networks of neurons organized in the brain, these levels of analysis are nested into a net output of the brain such that time is one of the primary organizing principles here. So, coincidentally, time is an organizing principle of our world also, and it's inherent in every aspect of learning, from learning mathematics in the classroom. Of course, the order of operations is going to be very important, and so if you have a problem sequencing, oops, you may get something incorrect. Of course, language comes in the auditory stream, and order there is also very important, and it has very many implications for meaning or outcome. And even in learning sports or dance, the sequences of events, of actions, underlie much of what we learn. So not only does sequence matter, but we need to be able to predict from one time point to the next what the appropriate action is given a particular stimulus. What do I mean by that? We rely on memory to know what one stimulus might predict. For example, it may seem very basic, but in fact, we do have to learn to look before we cross the street. And if we don't, then there might be a very deleterious outcome to that, or a very positive outcome. So there needs to be a way for us to make these predictions. And in fact, the brain really is a prediction machine of sorts. So when we go back into these sequences, there are really temporal regularities in the world, and the brain needs to work very hard to abstract these temporal regularities such that any stimulus might predict another, and there's an appropriate behavior associated with the connection between those two stimuli. Our children, of course, are always learning these sequences in every domain, from mathematics to sports to reading to the social domain, where they may say, oh, this look, and they say yes, and look for the outcome. And so it's very important to understand the basic machinery of the brain if we want to go back and understand exactly how it is that the brain is organized in time and in sequences to create those basic cognitive operations that we ordinarily attribute to the brain's processing. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrea. And Jay Gidd is next. I'm sorry if you have to keep on turning around to find out where I'm popping up next. Jay Gidd is next. He's chief of brain imaging at the child psychiatry branch at NIMH, and also a practicing child psychiatrist.
I study the teen brain, which is sort of the Maytag repairman of neuroscience. But we've been using this approach of having people come to the NIH starting at about age 3, and we do various types of imaging, genetic studies, and neuropsych studies, and then follow them at 2-year intervals as they go throughout childhood, adolescence, and into young adulthood. What we found was that the white matter reflecting myelin and speed of neural communication increases throughout childhood, adolescence, probably into the fourth decade for men, fifth for women. And gray matter follows an upside-down U path. So somewhere in early to late adolescence, and then levels off during adulthood. And these gray matter peaks are not uniform throughout the brain. And we see in this movie, blue means maturation, in a sense, getting closer to the adult levels. And what was noteworthy was that the prefrontal cortex was so late to mature, so this part of the brain doesn't reach the adult levels till about age 25, which seemed rather late to us in terms of we can vote and get married and go to war and drive and drink and all these things, you know, well before that age. And so this raised a lot of speculation about what influences the build-up stage. Does anything we do as a parent or as a teacher or clinician nudge these curves for good or ill? Diet, medications, video games, bacteria, viruses, you know, many things, sports, music, may influence this, and we just don't know this well yet, but that's where a lot of the directions are going. And how powerful is the use-it-or-lose-it principle? In the sense of, does what we do with our brain actually in a physical way, you know, change what the brain's anatomy and physiology is? And if something goes wrong with this 1-2 process of overproduction and selective elimination, could that account for some of the psychopathology that we see, such as in autism, ADHD, and schizophrenia? But the single overwhelming theme that all of our data has pointed to is that in neuroimaging, as in life itself, it's about the journey, not just the destination. I think all of our sort of meaningful outcomes have pointed to this principle. So we have both the typical development maturation in terms of the sequence of development. When we look at the predictions from the imaging for IQ, if we notice the end of the curve, very difficult to see here, but at age 20, when we look at the groups that have high IQ, very high IQ, and average IQ, by age 20, the brain was not predictive at all of what was different. But when we ran the clock backwards and looked at the peak of gray matter trajectory, that's what discriminated the IQ groups. So here another example where, you know, the journey was more important than the destination. In our twin studies, we were initially interested in what parts of the brain are, quote, most heritable than others. But what became more interesting is that how dynamically heritability changes with age. So you can't even say this structure of the cerebellum is less or more heritable because it's so age-dependent, and this may relate to timing of gene expression, which may relate to onset of psychopathology during adolescence. And the final point is was mentioned briefly by Roger, and the sex differences in the brain. What we find most different between boys and girls is not so much the final sizes, but the trajectories of development. And that with the peaks occurring about 8 to 18 months earlier in the girls, on average, huge overlap between the groups, not constraints for, you know, for boys or girls, but that here again, all these examples sort of point to this notion of focusing not just on the final size, but along the path to get there. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. By the way, if you could just sort of tabulate these questions as we're going along, there will be a panel at the end and you'll have a chance to talk to these people about all these points that they're making. Terry Jernigan is next. Jay and I were talking last night and he made the observation that Terry, who is professor of psychiatry and radiology at UC San Diego, is in a sense one of the founders of the field that he's now working in. So we're delighted to have her here. And you'll also find some comments by Jay in that last slide that I showed, the one of yesterday's New York Times magazine on the sex differences and whether boys and girls should be taught differently in schools and so on. Anyway, Terry Jernigan.
Okay. Well, I'm delighted to follow Jay for a couple of reasons. He saves me a little bit of time, so he's already told you some of the things I was going to talk about. I'm here today in my new role as co-director with Joan Stiles of the Institute for Child and Adolescent Neuroscience, which is a new research initiative here at UCSD, which is focused on new studies, longitudinal studies of school-aged children, focusing on cognitive development and brain maturation. Now, the new center has two major goals. The first one is to describe the degree and the nature of the individual difference variability in trajectories of biological maturation of the brain's fiber tracts, and to link this to developing mental qualities in children, and with a special emphasis on those qualities that we think are going to be the most relevant in the academic setting. The second major goal of this center is to apply a more kind of data-driven or empirical approach to a description of the behavioral phenotypic variability, the whole universe of behavioral phenotypic variability in children, and maybe to learn something about the underlying genotypic variability in neural architectures that's related to this. Now, I'm going to skip through these slides because this is really to talk a little bit about the story that Jay just told you about our early observations when Paula Tawal established another research initiative here at UCSD that allowed us to study school-aged children over 20 years ago. But I'll just go straight to this wonderful, everybody's favorite summary slide, which is from Jay's program. He just showed it to you, showing that we observed this pattern of cortical thinning, this wave of cortical thinning that spread across the cortex from the sensory motor cortices into the what we call the multimodal and supramodal parts of the cortex across this age range. Now, even at the time that we first saw this, we had a pretty good idea that this apparent loss of gray matter throughout the brain was in some way, either directly or indirectly, very importantly related to ongoing myelination in the brain's fiber tracts. And in fact, you can see that at the same time that this is occurring, these are data from my lab, there's this dramatic increase in the volume of the cerebral white matter. This is reflecting this ongoing proliferation of oligodendrocytes and their deposition of myelin on the axons of these connecting fibers within the brain. And at that time, it was difficult really to pursue this investigation of fiber tract maturation until the advent of a new MRI technique, which is called diffusion tensor imaging, which is actually sensitive to the structure and the biology of these fiber tracts within the brain. And in fact, you can process the information from this new MRI modality, like you see it's done here, to identify, at least in rough terms, the principal of fiber tracts that are known from animal studies and autopsy studies to be present in the human brain, and then to look at these tensor parameters, biological parameters in these fiber tracts individually. And this is work from Christian Boyeau's elegant program where he studied lots of individuals across the age range, and he's been able to show that if you look at these fiber tracts, some of them develop rather rapidly. In fact, they sort of approach asymptotic values on these tensor parameters before the age of 11, but some not until ages 15 to 17, and still others not until after the age of 20. So clearly a very protracted course of fiber tract maturation. But what is this kind of variability that you see here among individuals? What does this have to do with behavior? Anything? And the answer is very clearly, yes, it has quite a lot to do with behavior. This is just one example of a number of new studies that show this. Do I have a pointer? Yeah. This is just one of my favorites from Bruce McCandless's group, showing that a measure of tract organization in this region in the white matter is associated with variability in 6 to 10-year-old children on a reading task, whereas this more anteriorly lying area, the fiber tract organization there, is more strongly related to their performance on a working memory task. And in my lab, we have obtained evidence in 7 to 13-year-old children that another DTI parameter, which has been linked to ongoing myelination in this inferior frontal gyrus region, is associated with performance variability in these children on a measure of behavioral inhibition. Whereas in this region of the superior longitudinal fasciculus, another fiber tract, the parameter there is correlated with performance on a spatial working memory task. So, the important question, of course, is how do we interpret these associations? And how we interpret these associations has to do with what we think the nature of the underlying variability that mediates them is. So if fiber tract maturation in the neural systems of different kids follow a very similar curve from one child to the next, and they're very tightly linked to chronological age, then these associations couldn't be due to developmental variability. But it could be that even if the curves are very similar from one child to the next, that for kids of a given age, there's phase variability. That is to say, the brain maturation is in a somewhat different phase from one child to the next. And in that case, this kind of variability can mediate these associations. By the way, these associations are almost always present, even if you control for chronological age. Fiber tracts can also show maturational curves that are different in shape, by the way. But of course, this could have nothing to do with development. It could be that underlying more trait-like differences that are present throughout development are really the reason that we see these associations. And we really don't have the data yet to determine the differences between these things. So I just wanted to say in closing that the really critical, the reason this is so critically important is one question we could ask is whether this kind of variability in fiber tract maturation has anything to do with developing academic skills. And here's some data from Sharon Griffin, who's one of our principal consultants in ICANN, showing the mean change in number knowledge over this range established longitudinally. But look at these different individual children, the data from them. Look at the differences in the trajectories that they show. These are the ones in color here, relative to this mean curve. And the question is, could this variability have anything to do with the differences in maturation of fiber tracts in the brain? And also critically, could the interventions, like the intervention that Sharon has developed to increase early math fluency in young children, could it have different effects depending on the phase of brain maturation that the child in the child's neural systems that are the neural systems that encode this kind of knowledge? So I'll stop there. I see that I should stop now, but thank you.
Thank you. One of the things that, in case you're wondering about the order here, one of the things that we try and stick to in these meetings is the comment by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late senator, who said that everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. So we've been trying to get some facts up front in the meeting, but because there's a lot of facts, and we don't want to sort of give them to you all in one chunk. You'll see that there's a school section next, and then there will be some more science during the children's section as well. So next up is Catherine Hirsch-Pasek, who's professor of psychology at Temple. And she's on the screen over there. With some luck, she will chew gum and speak and turn a switch and a lever and will talk. And Kent will make her sound.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Amazing. Technology, so cool. Anyway, thank you very much. And hello from Philadelphia, where we have been musing about mind, brain, and education. And today I want to present 3 points and 3 questions. I also want to thank you very much for putting me on the program. Many of you there already know that I don't do brain research. So I think I'm really meant to be a kind of transitional person. And I'm also, I think, listed as the kind of skeptic on the program. But I'd like to recast that to be one who really wants to find balance between the skeptic and the cheerleader in this research as we move from the brain research into understanding schools and education. So today I want to make three points. The first point is caveat emptor, a word on dissemination and responsible, I'm sorry, you can't hear me? Next slide. A word on dissemination and professional responsibility. Second, a focused approach to discovering relations between brain and education. And then I want to ask, is the brain data the holy grail for education? So let me move to point one, which is a kind of caveat emptor in the issue of dissemination and professional responsibility. And I see some of my pictures aren't coming up, but hopefully you can imagine. There was a wonderful book that came out with Melissa Welsh Ross and Lauren Fessick in 2007. And they suggested that we really have to think about how to disseminate, and I'm so thrilled that everyone here is doing such an amazing job of it. They write, scientists have long tried with varied success to explain the value of their work. Despite this history and increased demand for science-based approaches, research can lack realistic ideas about what communicating and disseminating science entails. And I think a recent example from the 80s and 90s when I grew up, next slide please, really makes this point so well. We weren't so good at disseminating at that point and at telling the public what we were about. And so when the first research came out and said, infants know about number, it was interpreted as infants need to learn math. And when the next finding came out that infants recognize phonemes, it came out as children should learn to read earlier. And when the next one came out that synaptic pruning occurs early, it was interpreted as the critical period for brain growth closes at age 3. There is amazing brain science that is relevant to education. And you have all seen that even in the 5-minute thought bombs that you've gotten so far. In Talal's work, in Klingberg's work, it's really incredible how we see changes after we intervene in brain education. There's also a lot of research going on, next slide please, about mechanisms of learning that may not at this moment be directly translatable into curricula, whether it's the math research from Dehane or McCandless's on reading, which you just heard about, and the many other great research projects that are going on. So when we have conferences that are led by us and our colleagues, and we advertise, next slide please, that neuroscience has the powerful tools to greatly improve education, and that we know how to rewire the brain to improve learning, I agree with the enormous potential, but I wonder whether we are disseminating our findings in a way that may be overselling a little bit of what we have at this moment. Next slide. What is our professional responsibility as we disseminate these findings? Next slide. Taking us to point two, how do we help people focus on the real thing? I did a simple Google search of brain and education, and I found 12,500 million hits. Yet the first journal on mind, brain, and education came out in March of 2007. It feels like there's somewhat of a disconnect here. Next slide. So the question I'd like to ask is, how can we help educators focus on the real findings as opposed to the marketing? I mean, everything is brain-based, right? And so how do we help educators and policymakers speak the same language and learn how to separate the wheat from the chaff? Do we need a kind of scientist seal of approval? Next slide. And furthermore, how might we focus on ways in which our brain data best translates into educational practice? I think what we've seen so far today in looking at the timing and sequencing literature is that it's not necessarily about the what or the curriculum-based education, but maybe more about the how. Maybe it's more about pedagogy and how we might sequence the information that we have, the timing at which we present things to young children. Next slide. So focusing on the best data and the best use of our data can make our translations to practice even more effective. Finally, next slide, as we accumulate our data, we need to ask whether brain science offers, next slide, point three, the holy grail. That is, to what extent does the brain data that we have heard today and will be hearing throughout the course of today offer important converging evidence for behavioral, by that I mean cognitive and social findings, that were already in the literature? And to what extent is the brain data leading the way in the science of education? Next slide. we must be careful to confirm and extend what we know in cognitive science, but not to ignore years of scientifically powerful behavioral evidence that has accumulated on what and how children learn. And again, I've been thrilled already to see all the talks because they are confirming that cognitive science and behavioral science. Else we will run the risk of using brain data as marketing or as a way to sell old wine in new bottles. So for my thought bomb, next slide. I would like to leave the town meeting today with three questions to think about as we move forward. Next slide. First is the dissemination question. How do we realistically translate and disseminate the brain findings that we have in a professionally responsible way for use in education? Question two is the focus question. How might we help educators find the real science and appreciate the focus on processes of learning, not just on products of learning? And question three, the holy grail question. What do we know from brain research that is different from and extends what we already know from behavioral research? Thank you.
Kathy, thank you very much. Those last three questions, in fact, will be significant questions in the panel that follows this, so we'll get to those. Next up is Mike Mersnick, who's actually the chair of otolaryngology in the Keck Center for Integrative Neuroscience at UC San Francisco, but better known for his work on neuroplasticity and for being a founder of Scientific Learning Corporation. And you, if you were watching your local PBS station last night or the night before, you may well have seen Mike on there. Mike Mersnick.
I'd like to begin by making a disclaimer. And that is, I'd like to have been the discoverer of brain plasticity, but actually it was discovered in the 19th century, so I was a little late for that. And also many scientists have contributed to the elaboration of brain plasticity science in this century, all across it. And so I'm a sort of latecomer, but certainly it has been a focus of my own research and interest. I'm going to start by talking about issues of perspective, And not so much science, so maybe I'm also kind of a bridge between these two, because actually tens of thousands of republished reports relate to issues of brain plasticity, and it's very, very difficult for me to deal with that in 5 minutes. The first thing I want to say is that real progress in educational science requires that we change the achievement trajectories of underperforming children. That's obviously true. And also that we've created some of the key tools that apply brain plasticity principles. We've tried to translate this out into the world in the initial form, still with limited knowledge, still with limited understanding, but we've made initial tools which improve the processing efficiencies, the learning rates of school-aged children. And we have a lot of understanding from science and from this practical experience about how this ought to and can progress from that point forward to improve those learning rates and efficiencies. And then also, there are obviously advances in technology that are critically enabling the delivery of these tools into our schools. And this has been an absolutely crucial aspect to convergence of the development on the technological side that allow us to deliver these with the efficiency in a practical way that improvement of the brain capacities of children can actually be achieved. And I think the task before us is a reinvention of the 21st century schoolhouse to create environments that create more effective brains that help every kid, their brain, achieve at a substantially higher level. And I don't think it's too late to start. I think we have started in a sense, and I don't think I'm overpromising anything. I think that we know enough, we have enough knowledge, we have a first approximation of how to progress, how to proceed. We obviously need good models, and those models have to be elaborated and played out in schools, in model schools, to demonstrate what we can achieve. But we can proceed, and we can make a hell of a lot of progress if we just get to it. And my irritation, in contrast to the last speaker, it relates to all of the impediments, all of the reasons we find not to proceed. That to me is equally or even more frustrating and in a sense represents another level of irresponsibility. And we have a lot of brain work to do if we're to help all children their brains achieve at something approaching their optimum performance levels. We have to improve the fundamental processing abilities that support high resolution, that is to say, high accuracy, high speed, highly efficient brain processing. We have to ensure that their elemental skills training provides benefits that generalize to higher order memory and cognitive abilities. And training must obviously engage systems across the great modes of brain operations, because the impacts of training are substantially modal. So if you really want to improve a brain across the sweep of the operations of a brain, the training has to be relatively elaborate. Training must extend to the elaboration and enrichment of every child's cognitive or executive control abilities. And it can, and we can demonstrate powerful abilities or capacities in that respect. And finally, computer-assisted training supported by classroom extensions that bring the values of these the child's gain into the real world, initially in the real world of the classroom, is obviously absolutely necessary. There are very few schools in the U.S. who have technical resources that are up to this job. I might say I just realized at this point that I have two talks, two sessions, and what we are looking at are the images for my second presentation. So maybe we have this in reverse, okay? No school is organized to achieve it. And it's not just about slower kids catching up. The real goal is to help every kid be the best that they can be. Now, we've already illustrated the power and the practicality of this strategy in animal and human studies of brain plasticity by creating an initial practical model that is transforming children in schools. You have to understand that this is just a first attempt. This is just a first approximation. And lots more can be done now. But what we are doing is it being accomplished in a practical and a deliverable way with relatively little spent time by the child at relatively low cost. And we are improving the brains of these children, there's without question. And an unprecedented level of control of individual child outcomes, because when we have technology-assisted learning like this, assisting the classroom teacher, then we can actually control to some extent the outcome, how the child is progressing. We know what to prescribe to a given child to achieve a specific outcome because of the ways that we can close the loop on the process of learning and advancing brain change and brain power. Now, what would be required to implement this more complete, better brain educational model? Again, this is my second talk. Right? This is all about transformation, right? The science will come later. We need to invest in elaborating and refining these technology-delivered brain training schools. We need to create model schools. We can do this now. We should be investing in this now. In linking with science, and not, as the last speaker just pointed out, not just behavioral science, but all of the, not just neuroscience, but all of the history of behavioral science, of experimental psychology that has contributed so much to this. We need to bring this all together into model schools in which the whole goal is to improve not what children learn, as was just described, but how children learn, how their brains are engaged to learn in ways that will increase their effectiveness and empower them child by child. We need to further invest in schoolhouse infrastructure to really make this possible. So that's basically what I had to say in my second talk. And I might say my second talk was transforming if it came in the subject and the position. Now my second talk on science will be a little bit of dead air, but there you go. Thank you.
Well,
Urs Ribri is leadership chair in cognitive neuroscience in childhood health and development in BC and a professor of psychology at Simon Fraser University. You moved there somewhat recently, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a neuroscientist using brain imaging technologies and using imaging brain technologies, which makes it possible to look completely non-invasively inside the human brain without even touching a subject or a patient. You can image brain structure, brain function, and brain dynamics. I'm particularly interested in underlying networks who produce and generate and contribute to such normal, abnormal, and pathological cognitive brain functions. So again, there's lots to talk about, but one of the striking examples which really struck me was one example happened in the 90s in a collaborative consortium on language-based learning disability, dyslexia, together with Paula Tallal, Mike Mertzenich, Steve Miller-Jenkins, who were focusing on intervention plasticity, and Rodolfo Linus, myself, imaging network dynamics on animals and humans, and several others. So what happened there is basically based on 5 milliseconds, based on 5 thousandths of a second, we were not only able to distinguish controls from dyslexic, but even distinguish two subgroups. This, I believe, is amazing when we consider that in a context of sensory processing, that if the stimuli, in this case a click, reaches the ear, it takes about 15 to 20 milliseconds that the stimuli reaches the surface of cortex. About 10 milliseconds later, we already see some communication between subcortical, cortical, thalamocortical areas, a very dynamic event where such changes can be seen. Around 100 milliseconds, the stimuli reaches primary sensory cortex, so basically the brain knows, ah, I hear something. About 200, 250 milliseconds, the brain can notice differences in physical properties of the stimuli, so it notices there's something different, although we are not aware, the brain is not aware yet. Around 300 milliseconds, there's awareness, the brain knows there's a high tone, a low tone, and can make a decision. So again, this happens within the first tenth of a second. We are not even aware of the stimuli, and based on 5 milliseconds, you can distinguish a normal versus a normal learning brain versus a brain who has difficulties and even see subgroups, which was not possible otherwise. This, I believe, is amazing and clearly indicates the importance of focusing on early sensory perception. And two, it also shows the importance of focusing on the fine temporal signatures in network dynamics. You have the capabilities and actually can see such differences. Let me very quickly elaborate on this particular experiment, just one of many examples, and how we can do such experiments with brain imaging and what's the impact for the learning brain. Again, in this case, there were two clicks separated by different intervals, and it turned out that it takes about 15 milliseconds to distinguish two clicks. It sounds different, but if they're together less than 15 milliseconds, you cannot say if it's one or two events. After 15, you can clearly distinguish one or two. So we looked at the behavioral side. We asked the subject if they perceive one or two. We computed the thresholds for the occurrence of the second stimuli. We also looked in the brain. We looked at such communication between subcortical, cortical areas in a frequency or brain rhythm related to cognition. And also there, it indicates that you see one, a resetting of one or two responses. And again, doing modeling and computation and describing such threshold. Well, it turns out that the behavior, if you ask the subject, if you look inside the brain, that correlates quite well. It takes about 15 milliseconds when the subject tells you they hear a second stimulus. It takes about 15 milliseconds to see a second event in the brain. A clearly significantly statistical significance cluster. And then we see differences in dyslexia. So what does it mean? Without going too much in detail, you can track such a response, such a rhythm, which takes about 2-3 cycles in this case, with different stimulus intervals. So in controls, basically, when you look inside the brain, you see one, and when the subject perceives the second one, you see two responses. In dyslexia, and that's where the 5 milliseconds comes in, it takes much longer to perceive a second stimuli, and it takes much longer to see such a second event. And again, it correlates quite well what we described as dyschronia. There was a different subgroup. It was not surprising, but quite somehow a surprise, but not something we could expect. A second subgroup, what happened there? Again, without going too much into detail, while the first group, they have an extension when suddenly it is areas start communicating and oscillating, processing this information, it takes them much longer, so there's a delay. The second group has a problem in resetting. What happened there is they may be organizing a communication among the subcortical cortical areas. If a new stimuli comes in, they start again and probably delete the information of the first one, so which would relate to backward masking. Again, very briefly, we have capabilities now. There's EEG or in so-called MEG, what we had at NYU Medical Center. And this makes it possible to look at these brain rhythms in parallel. You can split up frequency versus time, meaning you see the you see these different brain rhythms happen at different speed. You see the subject is awake, and you also can actually track and extract such oscillation or rhythms which relate to cognition, and we can localize that. We can look at their dynamics, what we published earlier, which was a very dynamic event. You see frontal, main sense area, parietal area, and within subcortical, cortical. So it's a very dynamic, three-dimensional, organized communication among these areas. And you can write models. Rodolfo Linus and myself described that some years ago, which could generate the content and put it in a context of other stimuli. So again, there are other techniques now. You can actually make correlations to other brain areas and make this long-range synchronization and extract the entire network. So again, by approaching the learning human brain, which is a continuous refinement of neural circuitry, we have the capability of brain imaging to look at detailed changes, brain structure, brain metabolism dynamics. And most importantly, I think we have the capability of to see it, find the brain's functional connectivity dynamics. That means the tuning or coupling within local circuits, among local circuits, embedded within a large distributed networks to capture such connectivity or sequence of connectivity over time. And clearly, the fine temporal structure is important. We have capability to understand the learning brain, and we have the capability to see differences in cognitive abnormalities or pathologies. Thank you.
So Catherine Hirsch-Pasek can also hear us and see us, and we'll be able to pipe up when needed. What we're going to do is just ask a few leading questions, start some conversation going. You are free to sort of join in with this. There is a Q&A, obviously, at this point. Since this is going on tape, if you start shouting from where you are, yes, we will all hear you, but no, it won't do any good because it won't go on tape. So would you mind, please, if you can try and remember to put your hand up, and then somebody will find you with a microphone, and then that should work out just fine. So can I just begin with this, with the some of the opening remarks from the program itself, where there was a quote I pulled out there, this whole notion of whether neuroscientific research at this stage in its development does not offer scientific guidelines for policy, practice, or parenting. That was taken from the Santiago Declaration. I mean, how many of you in here know what that is? There was... do you want to deal with that, Mike, or?
I didn't understand if that was a question or a statement.
The question was to start a discussion about, and perhaps have you engage Kathy and then bring in the others as well, on whether neuroscientific research at this stage, if we are talking about a science of educating.
Right.
And there's all, I hear some dissent about whether the science is neuroscience or that it's just behavioral science.
Well,
and we're all infected by magnet madness, and we're finding modules in the brain for all sorts of things and so
just
on.
Just like the brain doesn't
confusing.
Make these divisions between processes,
right.
Nor does science, nor should science.
Right.
Right. And contemporary neuroscience of learning is an extension of experimental psychology, of course, and really any intelligent progression in the neuroscience of learning employs the information that's come from cognitive neuroscience and from experimental psychology. So, of course. Now, does it have anything to contribute that's beyond what's been? Is a deeper understanding of the rules, the real rules of the brain, does that have value? Is an understanding that of what the fundamental resources that a process requires in order to accomplish a higher behavior, does that have value or meaning? Those things that we can discover in the brain, of course it has meaning. Of course it has value. Of course it elaborates and makes more useful the science and the use of the science in extension for the benefit of human populations. So, there is no neuroscience that's separate from behavioral science. They are, in fact, all part of the same family. And of course it has application. We have now conducted thousands and thousands and thousands of experiments that show that brains change as a function of how they're used. And we have an increasing understanding of how to control that change in a sense for human benefit. So of course we have things to do with that science and extension for human benefit. And so I think, in fact, I think that we're, the rate at which we're accomplishing that, that practical translation, is incredibly slow. And I think one of the hang-ups that we have is that we have all of this really beautiful, elegant science that's documenting how brains do change and how brains do evolve across a child's lifetime, and a lot of observational science that tells us all about children that are variously doing well or not so well, and we're just clumsy as hell at translating out to the benefit of these children. So that's where I'm coming from. Of course, we have lots to help.
Let me just ask a quick question. How many of you here are actually scientists? So about a fifth. How many of you are educators, teachers? Lots. That's great. How many of you are education policy people? All right. Okay. And how many of you are AN other, something else? All right, so now you know who you're speaking to. There's lots of teachers here. Terry, do you have anything to add to what Mike said? Or Kathy, if you want to say anything, you have to squeak over there or something, because I can't. Or wave.
All right, I'll wave. Can you hear me on this mic?
Yes.
I'm picking up. All right, well, I just want to say that I completely agree with your answer. I have seen, however, so many things, as we all have, that have come out in the literature promising curricular-based education, and I just think that it would be wiser for us as we are speaking today, and I think we've made this analogy just a lot today in many of the talks, is that we're talking largely about processes when we talk about these translations and the how to teach and the pedagogy. And I think quite often we confuse the curriculum with the pedagogy. I think we have information about both, but I do think it's important to keep them distinct at this point in our development.
Terry?
I'd just like to point out that we shouldn't expect discoveries in the lab to instantly be translated into the classroom. And the reason is that if you look at discoveries in physics, for example, Charles Townes discovers the laser. Well, it took several decades for that to create a practical laser that you could use you can buy off the shelf. And then another couple decades before you have a laser point in your hand. And that's because there's a lot of development that needs to go into translating the basic discovery into practice. And this, another example would be medicine. Important discovery made about, say, the importance of cholesterol in heart disease. But it takes several decades before you create a drug and then test it in clinical trials before you actually have it out available to the general population. We're at that, in many cases, at the very first step. But we can already begin to see the steps that are needed from here to take us to where we want to go. But if we don't start walking in that direction, we'll never get there.
So, but how does that differ? Maybe some of the teachers could answer this. I mean, you're talking about the development of a piece of machinery there.
No, so, I'm talking about actual practice. In other words, the finding out, from some basic discovery like Rusty's discovery, he's finding, the conditions under which the cells will survive, and the question is how do you best create the environment and the conditions for that to benefit education.
Do you have that in mind when you're doing this work? I mean, is that I'm not saying it's foremost in your mind, but at least is that a consideration, a major consideration?
I think that once an observation in the laboratory becomes established in other laboratories as well, so it's generalizable and other people can study it in the same way, then you begin to think about its applicability. Sometimes the discoveries are at such a threshold or cutting edge that they haven't been generalized yet, or they haven't been established as a principle. But in the case of birth of new neurons in the adult brain, the hippocampus is something that's been replicated and demonstrated. Now, immediately then the question becomes, how is that regulated? Can you have more of it? Is it something that is of use? And that has also progressed in the literature, so that this phenomena, that physical activity, as Terry was saying, exercise, increases neurogenesis in the adult brain, and the consequences have been demonstrated to show physiological changes, morphological changes. It's not hard to think about the impact that that may have translated to children or adults. And it has been already
applied in settings of the elderly, where increasing physical activity for the elderly in certain settings has improved cognitive performance. You know, this is something that seems like a, as we say in the business, no-brainer to
Roger.
To try with yeah. kids as well. And there are imaging techniques that are being developed to be able to monitor the changes that are going on in the brain, but it doesn't seem too early to begin thinking about ways to reinforce physical education back into our classrooms as a way of an auxiliary to what other strategies we may have, but just as one small example.
Yeah, and those early slides that I used, in fact, with the covers of the New York Times magazine, what is play for? It seems astounding, doesn't it, that we actually still have to ask that question, don't know. But in some sense, educational sort of theory doesn't seem to advance much beyond Rousseau's Emile, from what I can see. there was some...
A couple of years ago...
Who you are, but could you identify yourself, please?
Name's Eric Jensen.
Eric, thank you.
Yep, educator. A couple of years ago when I was asking Dr. Jernigan about how far, how much should educators go in terms of translating this, she might not remember this, but I remember she said, well, you know, lots of times it looks like there's an upside, but make sure there's no downside. And so, you know, I've been excited, as many people have, about neurogenesis and strengthening my support for physical education in schools. So the only little tiny quirk I have as an educator, not a quirk, I guess, as a concern is, hopefully Dr. Gage's laboratory hasn't found any downside in neurogenesis. And so that'd be a question that ask is, so far, is it still good, no downsides?
Well, there's a piece in Science News last week about stem cells and aging. Do you want to talk about
that? Well, yeah. Neurogenesis clearly declines with age, so there's that. But I think your question more is there any evidence that an increase in neurogenesis has a negative impact?
Not too much of it. Could you get
yeah. So what does happen in a variety of diseases like stroke and in epilepsy in particular is that the brain reacts to injury by increasing proliferation. So there's a compensatory attempt by the brain, just like the immune system in response to an injury, brain response injury by increasing this proliferative response. And there's some evidence that under in epileptic conditions with chronic epilepsy that the new cells that are born under those conditions can wire inappropriately. Whether or not they actually contribute to the subsequent seizures or not, it's not clear. But there's an example, one that we think of. In the other cases, like in stroke, these are injury conditions. Under normal conditions, we haven't found the downside yet. But in a stroke condition, there's a massive proliferation of new cells in the structure, but they generally die off rapidly and take with them a lot of bystanders. So so far, that's the one thing that we're finding, is that the upside is that the brain tries to repair damaged situations, and sometimes that attempt at repair may not always be a good thing.
You had a question?
Yes. My name is Adele Diamond, and before I say what I was going to say, I just wanted to follow up on Rusty's comment, because there's work that not only shows neurogenesis, but work that the brain functions more efficiently, in particular prefrontal cortex functions more efficiently after exercise. So it's not just showing structural change, but it's showing that the structural change is actually beneficial. And the work has also been done with children by Chuck Hillman. And that's an important lesson for educators, because in these days, a lot of funds are getting cut from physical education. We don't have time for that. We have to spend more time prepping for exams. So it's important to hear that the physical education isn't just a nice add-on. It's essential to the academic excellence of the students. But what I was going to say is that every answer is a partial one. So in translating, we have to be careful. Will the thing that we think we understand today actually be shown to be different or the reverse later? And the gender composition of neuroscience, I think, is fairly reflected by the panel up here. It tends to be more male. And men tend to be more into technology than women. So you hear Gary's talk about the robot, the social robot, and you hear Mike talking about how expensive having these model schools will be. Well, Patricia Kuhl has some very interesting findings on language learning in children. She had one person who interacted with the children, very, you know, engaging interaction. Then she had exactly the same person doing exactly the same movements and speech, but on video. And then she had exactly the same person doing it on audio tape. And what she found is she found a dramatic improvement in language of the children from the social interaction with that person, but not the same benefit, no benefit from the video. So there's something to be said for the personal interaction. And when schools are looking to how can my budget afford all this expensive equipment, I'd like to suggest that they might not need all this expensive equipment. That a lot of the benefits that we're finding in neuroscience don't have to be done in such an expensive way.
Can I respond to that? Yeah, sure. And by the way, Pat Kuhl and Nandi Miltsov were both invited, but they couldn't make it. So.
Can I say something first?
Why don't you have a fight with Mike? And then
what?
No, go ahead, Gary. Yes.
I want to say that we're all in favor of teachers and teachers getting more pay, in fact, because they're the most important members of our society, aside from parents, I suppose. The robot that I just want to respond to what Adele said. The robot I showed you was made in Javier's garage, but he has ones now that, except for the touch screen, cost about $100 in their components. And the whole point of his research is to have this robot that interacts with the children, not just sit there and be a video screen, so that it reacts to their facial expressions. The point of the video I showed, I didn't take the time to make the point, was that the timing of that robot's head movements made a big difference in whether the children treated it as another social being. So that day, the video was taken on the day they speeded up the head movements, and the children started pointing for Ruby, the robot, and saying, "Look, Ruby," and Ruby go, "Whoop," and they never did that before. Just on the day they got the timing right on the head movements made it, the children treat the robot more as a social being. Not that we want to replace the teachers, we want to help the teachers. And, you know, these days when there's fewer teacher aides in the classroom, it's like trying to do dentistry with a hammer. It's a lot harder.
Can we just take Andrea first, and then I'll come back to Mike for a second? Or was that on that point?
It was on that point. I want to say that I couldn't disagree with you more. First of all, I absolutely agree with the conception that teachers and human interaction and social interaction is absolutely a crucial aspect of the incredible important educational resource. Technology is all about saving money. It's all about saving effort. It's all about accomplishing something. It's all about bringing a child into a situation where they can do something 1,000 times in an hour that they could only do a few times an hour individually without its assistance. It's all about basically delivering exercises that could change brains in ways that will really change them at very low cost. So we're talking about something that in the long run, if I can change the processing efficiency of a six-year-old by 20 or 25 or 30 or 35%, I completely change the long-term prospects of that little human individual in their forward-going life. And I can do that very inexpensively for amazingly little time. Give technology in the right forms a half an hour a day across the first several years of life, and you can drive a brain in its processing capacities to an incredibly high and empowered level in almost every kid, making very, very substantial improvements. Now, that's assistive to the teacher. It has to then be brought in, of course. Those gains have to be brought into the real world. They have to be brought in away from the computer into the real world. We all know that. And the teacher plays an absolutely crucial role. It's about helping the teacher. It's about helping the children by the power of this science and technology. Now, one other thing I want to say. Of course, the translation of this into schools has to be scientific. Of course, it has to be scientifically valid. Of course, schools must demand that the progression and the evolution of this is science-based. And of course, there must be a serious process of continuing education into the educational community so they understand what the hell that means. And of course, there must be outcomes continuously as this progresses from this primitive start to where this is going to go in 20 or 30 years, which is going to be amazing. That's all I have to say. Technology is your friend if it's used appropriately, and it's cheap.
Andrea.
I believe some of the comments that people have addressed actually fall under the rubric of preparatory states for learning, actually. And so your example of the teacher as a multimodal being is a good one, actually, because what needs to happen is the teacher needs to engage the students. On the other hand, the student needs to be appropriately engaged with the teacher. And so I think tying Mike's points into yours, that means that if you have children with different temporal scales and the teacher operating at one particular temporal scale, it will be important to go in and try to bring many of the children's temporal scale up to speed so it can be aligned and the children can all be engaged. You may have children who are particularly rapid processors who also be disengaged, so it may not be advantageous to just have the teacher slow. It seems that it might be a better idea to do what we can to tune brains up in a way that then they're prepared to receive the domain-specific knowledge. And we don't necessarily need to do that with domain-specific knowledge. As we've seen, there are other ways to tune the brains up and the temporal processing of those brains.
Could we, there's somebody over there with a mic, sorry.
Nancy Wilson. I welcome the dialogue, and I would just encourage you to take some hope by the fact that some of what you're talking about is happening in schools today. I'll use my state as an example. We don't have physical education. What we have is physical education and physical activity, 150 minutes per week in 20% of our schools, and we're expanding further. But these things are beginning to happen, so it's not that you're starting at ground zero.
Yeah, one actually other comment I wanted to make in relation to that is that the brain is not static either. So we talked a lot about neurogenesis, but one thing we didn't talk about is neuromodulation. And exercise also burns cortisol, which is a stress hormone. So in terms of preparatory states for learning, it's also important that we don't have a brain that's in a stressed state, in a fight or flight state, rather than a thoughtful state. So I think that's very important also.
Okay, we have two mics out. Let's go here first, and then
Betty Teller from the National Science Foundation. So right now I don't know if I'm an educator or a researcher. Many people here have the letters TDLC after their name, so Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center. And the words time have come up in many different guises, even in these very few presentations. But it seems to me there's not a lot of agreement about how people are using the word time. We just had Andrea tell us about different time scales. Neuromodulation was implicit in the idea of processes that happen over time. Yet when we got more to the smaller levels, if you will, the more molecular levels of the brain, we heard about sequential time, something happening before something else. We heard about absolute time in the click studies. And we didn't hear about, although I think it's in some of the published work, phase dependencies, that is, where things happen in relative time. In the translation from the basic research to education, I think we have to be extremely more precise about exactly what we mean by these words in given contexts and given situations. And I think even within these group of people who are doing wonderful work, I haven't heard any two people talk about time in the same way yet.
Can I say that?
Should have one of the TDLC folks answer.
I just wanted to say a simple thing. All of those things are plastic. We've done experiments on all of those dimensions, and in all of those behaviors in animals, and in every one of them, you can drive dramatic improvements of the operational characteristics of the brain. Why not fix them all?
Andrea?
So one thing that I briefly touched on but didn't explain completely was the idea that the timescales are nested. Okay, so you have timing at the level of the synapse, like Terry was talking about. Then you have timing at the level of the neuron in terms of spiking. You have timing at the level of the field potential. Those neurons that are firing are giving rise to the field potential, which is an ongoing temporal component of the brain. And you have different oscillators doing this on different timescales, and they need to be integrated.
And that integration is going to give you your output. So affecting one thing at one time scale is going to affect the whole system, essentially. And that's going to affect behavior. And so although we're all talking about time as though they're discrete events, this is obviously a continuous process. And each of these components is going to align with some sort of timing, okay? It's those basic principles of the brain and exactly how the alignment occurs that we're actually trying to figure out. At a longer time scale, I mean, Rusty's neurogenesis studies actually get at multiple time scales, the birth of a new neuron, the integration into one of those networks I was talking about, how it's going to affect that network, and how that might deal with, say, long-term memory, even, and how a day becomes a day, even, by the birth of a new neuron. So it may be very confusing in that sense, but we do need to remember that all the time scales are nested, actually. They're not discrete events.
Yeah, and that is one of the... I want to just continue to answer that. It's one of the goals of our center is to try and understand how the timescales relate to one another. And if he was here, Yuri Busaki, one of our investigators at Rutgers, would say that the brain is a giant oscillator. So, you know, this is an oscillation, you know, but our brains are doing that at multiple frequencies all the time. And one of the interesting, I just came from a conference in Salt Lake City, and one of the interesting things there, I have to tell the story, was some work by David Heeger, where he showed subjects, Alfred Hitchcock's Presents movie while they were in the scanner, the fMRI scanner that reads your brain activity while you're watching. And Alfred Hitchcock and Hollywood in general are very good at kind of synchronizing our brains to pay attention to particular things in the visual environment. And Alfred Hitchcock was the master at this. And in particular, he found that multiple subjects' brains were in synchrony over 65% of their cortex when they were watching the same Alfred Hitchcock movie, all the way up to the frontal lobes. And I think if we can figure out ways to make teachers the Alfred Hitchcocks of teaching, to synchronize the brains of their students while they're teaching, then we'll really have figured something out.
Well, you have to remember that Hitchcock also defined a movie as life with the boring parts cut out. So, Jakey.
And good teaching is teaching with the boring parts cut out.
Yet another aspect of time is the notion of sensitive periods, or whether we can tell from neuroimaging when an individual is ready to learn algebra or calculus or abstract thought. And what I saw this morning in terms of the movies of Dr. Gage and the movies I showed are very far apart. So the smallest part of my movies are a million neurons, trillions of synaptic connections. But is there a connection? Is there a connection between what we see on MRI changes and changes in plasticity? Is there time periods in life where we can sort of see the brain being very active structurally? And does that give us clues back to the educational realm? Which my other point is that there's a tendency, I think, to look at this as sort of a one-way street, as the neuroscientists gracing the educators with our knowledge and insights, when it's bidirectional, that the educators have enormous wealth of information to guide the neuroscientists as well. And this, I think it needs to be looked at more as this two-way street. Just a tangible example from our findings of the girls' brains, particularly the social ones, maturing faster than the boys, what I thought was a great insight running to the educators, and they're like, we've only known that for 100 years now, good way to go, Captain Obvious, kind of thing. That educators knew that already. It wasn't profound at all, but I didn't. I mean, I didn't know, from the countless hours in the classroom with actual kids. And so I think we have to being a little more humble as a neuroscientist and realizing that there's an enormous amount of knowledge from the educators that we're not incorporating as well. I don't think it's anybody's fault, but I think that the systems aren't well set up yet for this interchange. But just, you know, kind of extending the notion of timing, not just from seconds, but to decades.
Mm. That was one of the hopes in bringing this meeting together. You already have a mic.
Yes, thank you. Catherine Cross Maple with New Mexico and a public policy position for the state. As we look at garnering our resources for this strategic effect, and this ties very well with some of just the immediate comments, and we look at the aspects of what our behavioral research has taught us over the years and how that can be supported now by this very exciting emerging research, the neurologically based research that we're seeing and hearing about, and thinking about the timing and maturational levels and, you know, what's happening when and why, I want to tie it down to a public policy piece about having to raise the math and science achievement levels, the participation of students, both male and female, thinking about the timing issues, the differences between male and females, and some of the requests that we're getting to do gender-specific classroom experiences. I'd just like some feedback on how you think the work that we've been talking about this morning could help better inform our public policy around when we introduce, how we introduce math and science so that we do get those outcomes we're looking for. And that's a pretty global concept, I understand, but I'd sure be interested to have you pull from what you've been telling us about. Thank
you. Does anybody want to touch that?
Let's do one sort of very quick but tangible example. If I didn't know anything about education curriculums, I would say teach geometry before algebra. Where I am at, we teach algebra first and geometry. I have never gotten sort of a good explanation from educators of why that sequence, other than alphabetical. But in terms of that, but I mean, that's a very sort of concrete, tangible, you know, sort of thing. Why is it in that order when, from what I would understand from brain development, I would expect that geometry should precede, I mean, more spatial preceding the other?
Catherine Hirsch-Pasek, had your hand up before. Are you still?
Well, yeah, there were just a couple pieces I want to add, and I'm not sure they directly address this question, but they overlap the last two. I think a point that was raised earlier is that you might have individual differences. I'm hearing, you know, things like, let's tune the brain, let's fix the brain. And at least a couple people on the panel have mentioned that there may be differences, and when we bring up the gender, what we're hearing is differences. So the question is, can we come up with profiles, individual difference profiles, that we might be able to use brain data to identify along with behavioral data? And then what educators can do, and I agree with what Adele Diamond said, is you can begin to tune your teaching to these individual profiles. And that's what a teacher really does in many ways. She may not be Alfred Hitchcock, I agree, but they're pretty good at being adaptive. And what we've learned in the language literature is that adaptive contingent responding is what's really important for early learning.
So Paula Talala would like to respond, but do we have a microphone? Where are the mics?
Okay, I'll just use this one.
I got one.
No, it's all right. He's got one behind you. Destroy the furniture.
Yes, well, this is one of the most interesting aspects, and it raises issues from lots of the different questions, and that is we have been to so many education conferences, and the message is you've got to teach to the individual strengths of a child. You've got to teach individually. You've got to adapt individually to what each child needs. You've got one teacher and, if you're lucky, 25 kids and maybe more. So this is where technology can really be amazing, because technology can, in fact, learn. Smart technology and smart algorithms in teaching can be tools for teachers, where the technology learns from each child, trial by trial, what their brain needs, where their brain is, across multiple dimensions, and it's interactive with the child. That's why it's when you're using technology correctly, you're not just sitting a child in front of a video or in front of an audio tape. Of course that child is not going to learn in the same way they would from a human. But you can have interactive technology that can read for every child exactly across multiple dimensions, which would be very difficult for a teacher to do, even if they only had to be concerned with a single child all day long. So that's where we can work together as a group, as with many different perspectives, from the point of view of policy, to use all the data coming from all the different sciences. And I agree, let's not get into turf wars if it's cognitive science or psychology or neuroscience. It's a brain. And it's a child who has that brain living in a cultural and social environment. So how do we use all those abilities to pull together, plus the advantages that we have now? Technology today is what textbooks and other procedures were in the past. That's all. They're tools to help the teacher become more individualized for each child as they have to learn more content. And the final thing I want to say before sitting down is to really think from a policy perspective, I think, about the fact that there really are two very different things that are going on. One of them is what we call process, how the brain that the child brings to you is working, and whether that in and of itself can be advanced and enhanced to be optimum in the classroom. And the other is content. And our schools tend to focus tremendously on content, what it is the child is learning. And very little has been focused on the fact that we could potentially improve the child's ability to learn any content by making a better brain. And the analogy that I like, which is a very simple one, is that I pay an awful lot more to get a faster internet connection. And I can do all sorts of different things content-wise because I have it. And that's why I do it. So I don't want to be the child in the class left with dial-up when there are other kids who have, you know, broad bandwidth.
Thank you. All right, so we're almost at 10:30. There's some coffee outside. Let me just take a couple more things. You have a microphone there, and David wanted to have a quick...
Thank you.
Don't forget that most of these people are around later as well. This is not your only chance. I can find anybody in the audience at any time, so don't worry about it. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. My name is Raleigh Phelp from Azusa Pacific University, and this question is directed to Jay Geede. Last month, Scientific American had a rather dynamic article on the relationship between white and gray matter. And much of the work that you and Thompson and Gauthier and others have done is really based on a pretty well-defined gray versus white matter. Has that changed, or is there anything in this new research on white and gray matter and the relationship between the two of them? Will that have an impact on the work that you have done?
One of the unanswered questions is the gray matter thinning, which is an MRI phenomenon. There's less gray matter volume. How much of that is due to the white matter growing over that inner border? And it raises the larger challenge of what's sort of happening under the hood in terms of what is driving these MRI changes. But it seems like the direction seems to be the white matter, the sort of the other half of the brain, as Doug Fields mentioned in that article, and so long neglected, and what Dr. Jernigan is focusing a lot on, it's really coming into vogue as sort of, it's not just a matter of white matter speeding everything up as fast as it can go. It has to do with exquisite timing. It modulates. It doesn't just, you know, pedal to the metal, speed things up. And this modulation is the essence of thought and consciousness. Meaning in the brain is the synchrony, is the timing. And so I find it harder and harder to, you know, overstate the importance of understanding the white matter, gray matter. It's a very crude, you know, dichotomy that the MRI sees everything as gray or white. And literally, the box, that's all the choices it can have. And it's a very, I think, exciting direction that I should not speak for you, but Dr. Jernigan and others are sort of leading the way in this as well, of really understanding not just the volume of white matter, but its connectivity, its direction, and how it's really doing the fine-tuning of timing in the brain. Again, another timing issue, but white matter and timing are inseparable.
Terry, is this quick?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. A few years ago, I'm sorry, did you want to go next?
Okay,
so two Terry's here.
Two Terry. A dance team.
We did a comparative study across all mammals, of which range in size from the pygmy shrew, which has a brain about 10 grams, to whales, which are, you know, 10 kilograms, you know, six orders of magnitude. And what was interesting was that the ratio of the white matter to the gray matter, the slope of that relationship, is 1.0 I think, of 1.3, which means that the bigger the brain, the more volume is devoted to the white matter. And we have particularly big brains, which means that we have, you know, it's majority, it is great majority is white matter. And that's telling us something really important. I think it's telling us that we have to pay attention not just to computing, which is the gray matter, but to communication, which is the relationship, is how you send messages back and forth between different parts of the brain. And I think this is really the frontier, is trying to improve, if you look at an analogy to the internet, right? We have computers that by themselves are very powerful, but unless you connect them up in a very precise protocol, they're not going to be able to communicate with each other, and the power of the internet wasn't possible until that was done.
Okay. Terry, and then we'll go to break.
Before we leave this discussion, I'd just like to say that one thing, I agree with most of what's been said, but one thing that I'm a little concerned about is the focus on sort of global properties of the brain, faster versus slower learning, more white matter, more these things. And I want to remind us that we really, I think, need to begin to focus as neuroscientists and as cognitive scientists more on differentiation in neural systems. It may be that faster learners are in some ways faster learners in some respects, slower learners in other respects. We don't have the data. That's why this focus on the new research initiative I described is on individual differences. We don't know how differentiated neural systems are and how they develop and how they learn. And I think we really, if we're always confronted with the basic problem that a particular child is not performing up to expectations in some particular way. We often don't know very much about that particular child in other respects at that time. And I just feel that we really have to flesh out